From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson alongside Megan Mack. Hello, Megan Mack. It is Happy Friday. It's been a long week. Finally rolling out a year-long investigative reporting series. We are ready to settle down for a long winter's nap. In fact, Megan will next week, but she's off. Wait a second. I'm putting your mic down, not the music. That's amazing. There we go. Look, there's the music. It's there. Okay.
Next week, we're going to do a behind the scenes how this podcast is made or not made.
How about me, like, turning down your microphone and I'll just do the whole thing here. No, I turned on your microphone when I meant the music. That was really disrespectful. Sorry about that. Let's just keep rolling.
But we're not going to start over.
One take. No, it's just one of those weeks where we do need a long winter's nap because we've been working late, but I hope the community appreciates it because we certainly appreciate all the feedback we've had from our investigation series, Degrees of Diversity.
Yes, and you might have heard our series of five reports. Those are all available online along with interactive tools to allow you to search for diversity statistics in your own local school district. And I'm happy to say we've gotten a lot of great feedback, questions and comments, and it's great to hear that people are engaged. So we welcome you to do that as well, connections@wxxi.org.
And we're going to, in an upcoming podcast, bring together the entire series of reporting in one place, so we hope you'll check it out and share it. But now let's move on to our regularly scheduled Weekend Connections.
Let's open with a conversation that Evan has been calling one of his favorites of the entire year.
I would say favorite, even though it was heavy. I mean, it was riveting. Irshad Altimer is a criminal justice professor at RIT, and he came in to do two things. First, he shared his personal story as a victim of gun violence. And second, he explained how his experience growing up has informed his work today.
In 1997, Irshad was driving home from the movies with a group of friends. A gang member in another car pulled an assault rifle and fired 24 shots into Irshad's car. One of his friends was killed, and Irshad suffered 3 gunshot wounds.
It was a case of mistaken identity. He had grown up in a poorer part of Tacoma, Washington, and in this clip, he discusses how much pull gangs have on kids growing up without much hope.
Random white people, if you lived in this inner city black neighborhood when I was a kid, you know, random white people would stop us and ask us if we had crack, right? So you knew the people who didn't live here. They just see the first black kid, hey, you got some crack? I had that happen to me. Hey, where can I find some crack? And people would fall. So it didn't take much time to say, hey, if I get a few of these little rocks, I can actually make some money. And a lot of kids, unfortunately, got sucked into that and the subsequent violence and the arrest and all the other things that we know happened as a result of that. Some of the people who were trying to get me to join were my friends. So I was like, man, I'm not interested. I'm playing basketball. Hey, I'm trying to chase these girls. I always had an excuse. And then I also was fortunate to have another group of friends who were similar minded. We were like-minded in that we, even though we grew up in the neighborhood, we knew the kids who were gangbanging, we could hang with each other. And so once I had that, my own friendship group that was separate, I was able to somewhat isolate myself from that.
Would it have been easier for you to join a gang, or was it easier for you to not?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, and I think I was fortunate because my mother had moved like somewhat on the outskirts of the neighborhood. And so the pressures weren't as strong as for me as for some of the other kids. But still, I think in some ways it would have been easier for me to join a gang just because there was a lot of pressure if you're not in the gang, because you go to places and people don't know you and you have to deal with different people. And I think there's a lot of, it's interesting being a young black male growing up at that time because, you know, you're being targeted by the gang members, but you're all, the broader society also views you suspiciously just because you're from that neighborhood or from that area, right? So you're kind of caught in between kind of this kind of a very tough circumstance.
As you say, when random white people saw you, they assumed that you'd be...
They assumed I was in that neighborhood and I'm walking down the street. I got to have some crack on me, right?
What did you say to them when they
would
ask
for it? I say, man, just go down the street. Somebody will flag you down or something.
When it comes to the experience of being in a gang, that's something that is very abstract for people. And it's probably something that we don't fully understand. What would it have meant for you in 7th, 8th, 9th grade? What does that mean for you on a daily basis? Is there an expectation that if you're in the gang, are you absolutely selling drugs? Are you, you know, are you asked to do anything else? You know, what does it really entail?
I think a lot of, first of all, in these gangs, people have different roles. So, you know, there are certain people who are more violent than others. There are certain people who are selling drugs. You know, right now we have an issue currently with gangs in America, where you have some guys on the gang where they might not do much, but they make diss tapes on Facebook to diss other people, you know, so different people may have different roles. I think the biggest thing that attracted those young men, though, was just the sense of camaraderie and status and protection that they felt that they had from joining the gang.
Is it all male? I mean, is it mostly male still?
Mostly males, yeah, yeah.
How much have you examined what Rochester has?
So Rochester is interesting in that it's mostly like loosely defined crews, and these crews are amorphous. So we do have some gangs in Rochester, but if you look at a lot of the violence in Rochester, some's with defined gangs, some is with these loosely defined groups that they may take a name, but the name may change within 6 months, or the membership may change within 6 months. So it's very difficult. Rochester is unique in that a lot of the violence is really disputes between loosely organized crews as opposed to highly organized gangs.
Is it wrong to call it gangs?
Oh, no. I think there's some benefit to naming the groups if they identify themselves in some way. But I also think it's very dangerous for us to overstate the role of gangs and gang violence. Some of the violence that we see in Rochester is between, like, for instance, you may see retaliatory violence between members in gangs. But before we say that's definitively caused by the gang, we have to really understand the nature of that particular dispute. Sometimes, if we look at this closely, we find that this is really two people affiliated with gangs who are really beefing over a girl. Sometimes it actually is gang violence. So I think it's necessary when you have those groups to call them gangs, but it's also necessary to understand the nature of the violence that they're in and not overstate the role that gangs may play.
That entire hour is worth hearing. You can always find Connection podcasts on our mobile feed if you subscribe, and on WXXINews.org.
Next, have you ever gotten a red light ticket?
Yep.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, three.
Jeez, where? Three. Where did you get the ticket?
On the way to 490 near South Avenue. I think it's South. Yeah, South. There's one on South, right? South and Court. Something right around there. Yeah.
I always check the map when I feel like I've run one. Yeah. And there's never a camera there, so.
Yeah, no, I've had three.
Well, anyway, no need to worry anymore, because Rochester has had red light cameras since 2010, but Mayor Lovely Warren is recommending that the city stop using them at the end of this year.
And that's because research shows the tickets disproportionately impact people in poorer neighborhoods. We welcome the mayor, along with Eamon Scanlon of Metro Justice, to discuss this decision.
It's a law that's applied across the board equally. However, when it's applied, it disproportionately affects a segment of our community that we have to pay attention to. If you say that if you get the same ticket out in the town of Henrietta or Gates or somewhere else, and you are able to go before a judge and get that reduced, but if you get that same ticket in the city of Rochester and you can't get that reduced, you have to pay 100% of that fine, it's not fair. But that's what's happening today. And we are also disproportionately affecting people that live in the city of Rochester, because none of our towns have red light cameras. It's only in the city of Rochester that you have the red light cameras. And so we're disproportionately affecting those individuals again. And that's not right. And when you see it, you can either accept it and say, oh, it's okay because it's the city of Rochester, or you can do something about it. And here I'm choosing to do something about it.
Okay. Eamon Scanlon, I know your organization has been making similar arguments that you just heard from the mayor for a while now. What do you make of what you're hearing?
No, I agree completely. And I think you have to put it in a bigger context of how revenue is generated, much like the Ferguson report showed, on the backs of the poorest citizens in cities, on the backs of people of color. I would bring up institutional racism and the way that we are generating revenue to those who have been systematically disempowered. If you go around the city, even, you know, Mayor Warren brought up that they're only in the city, but they're also only in certain parts of the city. And I have worked close to them because, as a community organizer, I work in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, like one that I always passed when our office used to be on West Avenue, the one at West and Ames. And now we're at the one near the Hungerford building where North Goodman and Main Street is. But you don't see them on, you know, Monroe Avenue. You don't see them as much on the southern part of the city that is a little bit wealthier. So there's even a disparity in terms of where these cameras go just within the city, which is very telling.
Telling?
Yes.
Telling what?
It's telling that these cameras, when they were set up, were put in neighborhoods where I think they thought they would get the least pushback. And so it's communities that have been traditionally disempowered that are then put upon further to have places where the money would be extracted. That's the reason you don't see these in Pittsburgh or in some of the wealthier areas of the city, because those residents would go crazy. They would be like, get this thing out of here.
All right, well, let's ask the mayor if she thinks that's fair. Do you think that's fair?
No, well, you know, I was on a city council when the red light camera program came in, and a lot of people think that this was for revenue. And, you know, the mayor at the time, it wasn't about revenue, it was about safety. And it continued to be about safety throughout the 6 years that this program was implemented. It wasn't until year five that we started to look at and say, okay, well, we have enough data, we have enough information, let's evaluate rather this program really reduce safety at all of these intersections. And if you look at the intersections that the cameras were actually were placed at, they were the intersections where we had the most accidents and the most T-bone accidents and things like that. So they were strategically placed in areas where we wanted to, where we saw a significant number of crashes, and we wanted to reduce the crashes that were happening in those areas. And so we have the data to basically support the placement and why they were placed there.
Okay.
And as we talk about why they're not actually out in the surrounding areas of the city of Rochester or the suburban areas, it's because that legally they don't have the authority to actually implement a red light camera program. This authority was given by the state of New York, and it is given to, I believe, only the big five cities to actually implement this particular program.
Okay. So does that convince you on the placement there?
I'm not really. I mean, I understand the argument, but I think that it's a convenient one, and what is actually happening is what we have to be with. And where are these cameras? They're in these poorest neighborhoods. And I think that's actually why one of the reasons the mayor has decided to end this program is because that is where it's affecting those communities.
Okay, so there's agreement. There's agreement there. This is an argument that we heard from your organization sort of from the beginning. So Mayor Warren, 6 months ago when we saw the study, or at least I think in May, from the city released, did you know at the time the concern that there was a disproportionate impact on poorer neighborhoods?
Well, we suspect it. And so at the end of the day, when we look at if you're in this program, are you making your community unsafer? And so when you put the program in place, it is for the safety of the community, to reduce accidents, to reduce everything. If it's not, technically, you can't definitively 100% say that the red light camera program reduces accidents in all of these particular intersections where you have them, then what's the justification of the program, especially when it disproportionately affects people that are in your poorest neighborhoods that have no disposable income whatsoever to be able to pay these tickets. On top of that, you have a situation where you have many of those individuals on fixed income, Social Security and other things, that have family members that are driving their cars and getting these tickets, and they're responsible for them. And so there's a trickle down effect that you don't you didn't see in the beginning of the program.
Next, let's hear from a panel that went to Standing Rock, North Dakota to join demonstrators who are trying to block the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thousands of Americans from many different backgrounds have traveled to Standing Rock this year, offering support for Native American tribes.
And those tribes say this is a test of a treaty that's roughly 150 years old, protecting their land. Lauren Jimerson is a Seneca who described what it was like to recently go to Standing Rock.
I've been following the story for quite a while, and I've been hearing about this sort of majestic visual when you come upon camp, but it was like pitch black when we got there. But we felt it when we entered. You know, this woman at the entrance will tell you, you know, there's no drugs or alcohol, there's no weapons. She also told us that, you know, we're matriarchal here. Women and children come first, and men support us. So I had a friend that kind of led us into camp because he knew where we needed to go. And when she got done talking, you know, I said, Angel, I said, we're here, we made it. And I started to roll up my window, but then, you know, we smelled the campfire, and we could smell sage and tobacco burning. And, you know, I looked at Angel, and I'm starting to get emotional here again. You know, I started to cry, and I said, can you feel it? And there was singing. And so we both rolled down our windows as we drove down what's called Flag Row, which is the main drive-in. You know, I mean, we went in the blanket of night, but it was still this really powerful feeling entering the camp. And when we got to our camp, you know, we were surprised to find that my cousin was camped out there, and they actually, people got up and helped us put up our tiny little two-person tent, and it took like 5 minutes. But experiencing the people being united like that was just very moving and very powerful. You know, everybody was there for the same purpose, and that's to, you know, protect Mother Earth and all the inhabitants and, you know, her resources. And I don't know, just the strength and that unity that was there. You know, every night we went to sleep with singing, and every morning we woke up to singing, sunrise ceremony and water ceremonies, you know, various different languages, you know, different nations representing. And, you know, us being Seneca, it was just a great feeling, you know, because we have our own ceremonies. And some of our own people, you know, would do our ceremonies. And that was just really beautiful to see and hear and feel. So a lot of people just really focused on the violence that happened there. And I think that's easy to do. And, you know, no doubt should that be a conversation. But, you know, the peacefulness and the prayerfulness of the actual camp of the water protectors, you know, should also be part of that conversation.
We'll close the week with a conversation about Japanese internment from World War II. Recently, a surrogate of Donald Trump said that Japanese internment could be used as a legal precedent to allow the Trump administration to ban or register Muslims. This is former Navy SEAL Carl Higbee in an interview with Megyn Kelly on Fox News.
Trump's policy advisors are discussing drafting a proposal to reinstate a registry for immigrants from Muslim countries,
Yeah, and perfectly honest, it is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
You're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am saying is that we need to protect
that.
America.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it. And I'm not saying I agree with it. But in this case, I absolutely believe that a regional base...
You can't be citing Japanese internment camps as precedent for anything the president-elect is going
to
do.
Look, the president needs to protect America first. And if that means having people that are not protected under our Constitution have some sort of registry so we can understand, until we can identify the true threat and where it's coming from, I support it.
Our panel discussed the devastating historical impact of Japanese internment. You'll hear from Joanne Bernardi, a University of Rochester professor who has helped put together an exhibit that runs through this Sunday at the university. It includes photos and postcards from the time that show how racism was used to fire up war sentiment.
You'll also hear from Ken Warner, who has Japanese ancestry.
The rhetoric really began almost to a day of Carl Higbee's interview in November of 2015, when the mayor of Roanoke, David Bowers, referred to the need to stop immigration. I think he wanted to stop all aid to Syrian immigrants by referring to the internment camps and referring to FDR's decision as something that we need to revisit, as if it were a good idea. And the mistake he made was that he referred to the internment as being limited to Japanese citizens. He later apologized for that. But that was a huge red flag for me, that someone clearly didn't know their history, that he was referring to the internment as a model of something that might be useful in this day and age in terms of present immigration situations. Then that was followed by Donald Trump holding a rally on Pearl Harbor Day last year. And that was when he made his announcement. He made it shortly before the rally, but he started the rally by making those comments again about the need to halt all immigration until, and I think his quote was, until we can figure out what's going on.
Right. Do you think he's just ignorant of the historical context on Pearl Harbor Day to say something like that?
Well, that was my initial reaction. He was questioned about internment and what he felt about internment. And in both Time and I think on ABC News, he said he actually didn't know what he would have done. He really couldn't pass judgment on the internment. Those were his words. He couldn't say if it was a good or a bad thing. Although when he was later asked if he would favor internment for Syrian immigrants, he said no, he would not do that. But it was clear that he had ambivalent feelings, or at least, you know, felt it was okay to express ambivalent feelings about the internment, the Japanese-American internment, which is a historical fact.
Let me ask Ken Warner kind of a two-pronged question, because first of all, as someone of Japanese descent, I want your reaction to what you're hearing. But also, Ken, as someone who has worked in politics in a strategic way on campaigns, you understand that there are certain games that are played at times or certain rhetoric in campaigns, not at all excusing it. I'm asking you, given both of those parts of your background, if you took Trump seriously, if you have legitimate concerns that you feel like that wasn't just rhetoric from a campaign, that we should be gravely worried about this.
And how long do I have to do this?
Yeah.
You know, actually, when I heard it, I was outraged. And I was outraged not only for myself, but for this community that we live in Rochester, New York. A little known fact is that there are over 5,000 refugees, many of them Asian, but also from the Middle East and Syria, who live in Northwest Rochester. And we're taking in about 1,000 a year. These people are forgotten in this community. If we take 1,000 a year over the next 10 years, that means it's going to be a substantial population in that part of the community, over 15,000. It's outrageous. And what's even more outrageous, or equally outrageous, is the fact that we even call them internment camps. Remember when this happened? If we were in Germany, they'd be concentration camps. But the thing people have to understand is that they also interred Germans and Italians, not to the same numbers, but the fact that, and 62% of the people who were put in these, what I call concentration camps, were United States citizens. You had no protections under the Fifth Amendment and habeas corpus. It is outrageous. We should absolutely take it very seriously.
And that's it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Cue the music!
It works! And my mic's still on.
It still works. Your mic's still on? Mic is still on. You can hear Connections. Hold on, that's really loud. Oh my gosh.
We're having a lot of fun today.
This is a technical marvel to end the week. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM from noon to 2.
And you can always hear us on the WXXI mobile app. I hope you have a great weekend, a weekend that's better than the production quality of this podcast.
Well, that's not saying much. I hope you have an even better weekend than that. She's Megan, I'm Evan, and we'll talk with you Monday on Member Support Public Radio.